It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One billboard near the intersection of Bigelow Boulevard and Heron Avenue has become something of Pittsburgh lore after it first appeared in the summer of 2017. It started with a question: who is Pittsburgh's premier poet? Then it answered: Billy Nardozzi. Eventually, the theme of the billboard and the name of the poet would change again and again, but you could count on the same smiling face, a positive message, and a phone number. For The Confluence, Kylie Kaczynski sat down with the voice behind the billboard, Rachel Ann Bouvier.
So you've maintained this billboard since 2017, but recently folks have noticed that it's disappeared. Tell us what happened.
What happened was I ran out of funds. I did everything I could to keep them up. It was the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life. The way that I funded that was many different things. My pension money, I used my charge cards, I sold some musical equipment. In that last December one, I just couldn't get it up, so I had to cancel it.
What has the general reaction been to the disappearance of the board?
In a word, they say sad. It's a word that's used a lot. They're saddened by not seeing it. And it surprised me. I didn't know what's going to happen with this. I had walked in there and said, do you do anything with poetry and billboards? And they said, not really, but what do you have in mind?
You walking into Lamar Advertising.
Yes.
Yeah.
I live right by it. And I thought about it for years. And I never did it. I said, I'm doing it. I'm just walking in there. Well, it was so funny. When I first approached the woman at the desk, she says, I was all dressed up. She goes, can I help you? I said, well, maybe. I says, I'm looking to see if you do billboards having to do with poetry. To make a long story short, we had a conference, and it turned out they picked the location for me. You know, I went with it. I said, sure, whatever you guys think. I didn't know.
So you didn't even choose that intersection.
I did not, no. And they also invented the premier poet. Welcome to the premier poet. I would never talk about myself like that. I let people that follow myself, I let them say that. So I didn't. They picked that too, and it turned out great.
So then eventually the billboard took on a sort of theme and a different theme. How did that come about?
My previous submissions were in the Post-Gazette, where I had done the same about let it pertaining to a holiday. And I thought, why not do it on the billboards? And that's how it started. I said, let's repeat it on a billboard, much bigger.
So your billboard at first identified you as Billy Nardozzi, and then you eventually went by Rachel Nardozzi and now Rachel Ann Bouvier. Tell us how this evolution of your identity came about.
Exactly. I thought to coincide with my dress code and the way that I am, I said, I've got to change the name. The name's got to fit the appearance.
And for those listening right now, you're wearing a silky purple blouse, hoop earrings, some beautiful costume jewelry. So you've got to have a name that fits that. Is that what you're saying?
The whole package. Exactly, Kylie. So I always loved the name Rachel. I just thought it was a beautiful name. It came from the soap opera Another World, Rachel Corey. She was so pretty. And that was in my subconscious, so that was that. I said, Rachel, I got to get the last name. I didn't even like the way it sounded. Rachel Nardozzi, it didn't fit. So I thought, I got the name Bouvier from Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis Bouvier. That was her maiden name. I always loved her last name. I said, it fits, but I needed a middle name. Rachel Deborah Bouvier. Rachel, I don't know, millions. And it hit. And Rachel Ann Bouvier. That was it. It clicked. Billy Nardozzi has left the building. Rachel has entered.
Fantastic.
She's taken over.
Right. So your billboards always included the same phone number at the bottom. Is this your personal phone number?
It is.
What made you want to publicly advertise your personal phone number?
The reason being I was trying to promote my poetry, and I did. I got jobs out of it. And I was curious to see what people thought. Kind of bold. A lot of people said, you're nuts. And, you have to take a shot at things or you'll regret that you didn't. I just had to do it. And I do get calls, crazy calls. It goes with it. You put your phone number out there, you have to take either way or get out of the game.
So what was one of the crazier calls you've gotten?
Oh, middle of the night, like 3 a.m. You know, I hear the phone ringing in my sleep. I don't get up. guys at the bar, And I had a couple drinks. What's your story? You like the poems, but who are you? Are you like a dude or a girl? I'm not going to get into it, but
sure.
It was funny, harmless.
Mm-hmm.
Harmless. And most of them are very nice. Most of them are very nice phone calls.
So what do you hope happens with the billboard in the future?
I would love to get it back up and in the same intersection. It's the greatest intersection in Pittsburgh. I thank Lamar. They picked a wonderful spot.
Your face also used to appear quite frequently under the celebrations section of the Post-Gazette, and underneath the picture was a piece of your poetry. You've written about topics ranging from shop and save to taking Jesus to McDonald's. Where do you find inspiration for your poetry?
That's a great question. It just comes to me. Inspiration, yeah, many things. I listen to songs a lot and get ideas from it. It gets, you know, the feeling in them. I'm driving by places, talking to people. As I say, I just sit down and these things come to me. You know, I can't explain it.
Speaking of taking Jesus to McDonald's, we're going to have you read a piece of your poetry. And this one is called If I Met Jesus, and it appeared in the Post-Gazette. So here is Rachel Ambovia reading If I Met Jesus.
Okay. If I met Jesus, the first thing I do is shake his hand and thank him for this beautiful land. And then I would offer him a glass of wine and ask him if he would like to dine. And then I'd cook up my famous spaghetti and then celebrate his arrival with a slew of confetti. And then I'd bring out the pie of the day and then ask him if he would like to stay. And then I'd invite him to Sunday church service, knowing that I would be oh so nervous. And then I would treat him to breakfast or brunch and maybe go to McDonald's for some afternoon lunch. And then he would ascend right into the heaven before that I could even count to seven. And then I would call him on the phone and thank him so much for visiting my home.
You can just really hear the joy that you get from writing poetry. Did you always love poetry? When did this this interest, this talent, when did you figure out that you could be a poet?
It started 1978. I always remember this date. November 1978, my first poem was about the Beatles, which I love. And I sent it to a newspaper, and I got a nice response from it. And they asked for a photo. And that's when I thought, maybe I have something here. That's when it started. And I didn't go strong until probably 2006 when I started the Post-Gazette. That's when I started thinking, this is what I want to do.
Can people expect to see you appearing in the Post-Gazette again? Where can folks find your poetry now?
Now, Kali, actually, since the billboard is not up, I've started back with my poetry in the Post-Gazette, and it is there every Monday. I don't know how long, but it's in Post-Gazette right now, Mondays.
You're the subject of an upcoming documentary. What can you tell us about it?
His name is Brett Yasko. He's a wonderful person. He approached...
The director.
Director, yes. He had been following my poems for years in the Post-Gazette, and he approached me about making a documentary, and I wasn't about me? And subsequently, we've been going different places that I frequent, restaurants, bars, my home, everywhere. And he's been filming a day in the life of Rachel. And I'm very excited about it. It's real. It's genuine. They've asked me every question that you could think of. He wanted to take a shot at me. It was a 4th of July billboard. He said he just wanted to come up and have me stand by it. I said, oh, fine. Mm-hmm. Well, in my amazement, we're walking up to the billboard and all these horns are beeping. I'm like, we love you, Rachel. I'm like, I was really shocked. I didn't know what this would do. I went, oh my God, they're calling for you. So it's a great feeling. I just didn't believe it. I can't believe it. It's wonderful. Give me confidence.
So you're really having this moment in the spotlight. Do you feel that? Do you what would you say to that? And what would you say to the people who have come forward as your fans and have appreciated you?
I would say to them, thank you so much for making me feel like somebody. As I said, I can't believe somebody even calls me a celebrity. I go to stores and they come up to me, Rachel, and I really can't believe it. I'm just doing what I love, like you said. I'm just doing what I love. And I think people maybe feel when someone's genuine, and I hope they do feel that. And I'll tell you what, Kylie, I've always said this, and I believe it. I didn't say it. It's a saying. Fans can make you or break you. And I'm telling you, I hope they never break me.
And what do you hope to do with this moment in the spotlight? What do you hope to bring to people?
I want to get it right. I hope to bring happiness in their lives and maybe change it for the better and let them know that the world's not bad if you look at it in a good way and know that there's good people around.
Rachel Ann Beauvier, Pittsburgh's premier poetess. Thanks for spending time with us.
You're welcome, and my pleasure. Kylie, thank you so much for asking me. It was my sincere pleasure.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, Governor Tom Wolf recently set some pretty lofty climate change goals, including cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 26% in the next 6 years. What kind of commitment will it take to reach them? And in the wake of concerns about breaches in security in the 2016 elections, as well as cyber attacks that targeted Pennsylvania, a Blue Ribbon Commission today issued recommendations for improving the security of the voting process. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at WESA.fm.
Grand Funk Railroad found a lot of success with other people's songs. Their versions of The Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter, The Animals' Inside Looking Out, and Some Kind of Wonderful by the Soul Brothers 6 were all hits, but none as much as their take on the Jerry Goffin, Carole King tune, The Locomotion, originally recorded by Little Eva in 1962. As the story goes, Mark Farner walked into the studio 45 years ago today and started randomly singing The Locomotion. The band and their producer Todd Rundgren thought it was a great idea and got their version on tape. The song hit number one in May of the same year. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Although hip-hop is continuing to grow more and more popular, there is a growing number of artists toiling away making music off the radar. Bus Crates is a local hip-hop producer who makes a point of keeping his music different from what's on the charts. For The Confluence, Mick Stinnelli sat down with a musician to talk about how Pittsburgh and his family have shaped his career and his art.
Do you ever feel out of place with what's going on in the mainstream, or do you feel like there is
Oh,
like
absolutely. The mainstream is like a completely different world to me. I exist like on a whole other plane. It's different.
Do you feel like there's more of a lane for people like that now, though, because of the internet opening up so many different doors?
Oh, absolutely. The internet just broke open everything.
So a lot of that mainstream hip-hop scene is kind of in Atlanta right now,
mm-hmm.
which I know you moved there a few years back.
Yeah, I was there for about 4 years.
Why did you move there?
I was seeing somebody down there, and I ended up just moving down there. And I was there for 4 years, and it was an interesting time. Like, I don't know if you know, but I was in a couple of different car accidents down there. Once I got hit, the first time I got hit on my bike, and second time I was on a scooter on my way to my day job that I had at the time, and somebody coming the opposite direction made a left turn and cut me off, and I got smacked.
I know when that happened, there was a pretty big outpouring of support here in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely.
What was that like?
It was amazing, man, to see my home city showing me that much love and support and during such a difficult time for me.
How did people come together? What exactly happened?
There was they had a show for me over at the old, what used to be 720 down on the main, but on Butler Street in Lawrenceville. They had a little thing for me there. It was beautiful, man. It was beautiful.
What made you come back to Pittsburgh?
I've been kind of wanting to get home for at least a year or two, and I felt stuck for a while, but then things happened, and, like, you know, my sister had some kids, and I wanted to be home with the kids a lot, and then I ended up, she used to be my girlfriend, she's now my wife. She's here. That's really why I came back.
Mm-hmm. So it was family.
Family.
Was there any worry that leaving a place like Atlanta, which is really has a thriving hip-hop culture right now, might derail your hip-hop career?
Absolutely not. In fact, quite the contrary. As soon as I got back, things just exploded for me because it's a very difficult scene down there. If you're not doing a particular style of music, it's really difficult to, you know, be noticed or anything down there. So when I regrouped, I came home, and I just kept working, and things happened.
Was being back in that familiar environment, seeing all those places you used to hang out, record stores you used to go to, did that trigger a lot of inspiration for you?
Well, I think really what really triggered it was just being back in general. I mean, because a lot of the times these places that I used to frequent are no longer here, like Shadow Lounge is gone, you know, 720's gone. There's places that I used to frequent back in the late 90s, early aughts, they're all gone. So I have to find a whole new source of inspiration, so.
Do you feel like there is an environment here in Pittsburgh that can help young artists grow stronger?
If there is, I haven't really seen it yet. I mean, I might not know because I'm in the house all the time, but I haven't seen or heard much of anything about, you know, I hear new spaces pop up here, and they're like, of course, you know, you have Spirit, then you have Boom Concepts over on Penn Avenue. I mean, you have different little venues like that.
What do you think, from your experience as a musician, the city is missing that could help people grow and inspire each other?
I feel like something like, see, that's what was so great about the Shadow Lounge, because that was our place for that. That was our place to bring in artists who were known nationally, internationally, and also cultivate and nurture local talent. That place was what really, really did that best.
So for you personally, where do you see your music going in the future?
Up. Nowhere but up. It's a process when you're an artist and you're trying to get your sound out there, and you know, once certain people notice it, it just blows up from there.
Bus Crates is a producer, DJ, and beat maker. Bus Crates, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
I'm Mick Stinelli for The Confluence.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf kicked off the new year with an ambitious climate change goal. He wants to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions 26% by 2025 and 80% by 2050. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk reports, if that's achievable, it'll take a host of strategies.
When a power line needs repair, utility workers step into a bucket that extends high above their truck. Sarah Alexak with Duquesne Light in Pittsburgh shows me one of those vehicles.
This is all you're going to hear, just the sound of the fan and the batteries.
No idling that you get from one of the company's diesel trucks, and no tailpipe emissions. In addition to greening its own fleet, Alexak says Duquesne Light is working with parking authorities and local businesses to help install chargers for the public.
Your car is going to sit 8+ hours a day at a work site. It's a great place to charge up.
Better planning and incentives to increase electric vehicle use would result in significant greenhouse gas reductions for Pennsylvania. That's one suggestion for cutting emissions included in the state's most recent blueprint for addressing climate change. Pennsylvania is the nation's fourth largest emitter of carbon dioxide. Wolf based his new climate goals off 2005 emission levels, as coal-fired power plants shut down amid competition from cleaner natural gas and renewables. Pennsylvania is halfway to his 2025 target. Jay Apt with Carnegie Mellon University says that goal is feasible. As for the longer-term target,
the idea of having a goal of 80% reduction by 2050 will inform choices that we make now, because energy investments are very long-lived.
A gas power plant, for example, will operate for decades.
That's a big shadow that an investment today casts. And so having a goal now that articulates out 30 years into the future is quite reasonable.
many in the environmental community wanted to see the governor do that. Mark Schiebest is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's absolutely the goal we need, but the market by itself is not going to get us there. We really need to do it through policy.
Like enacting a cap-and-trade program that sets a limit on emissions, or boosting a law to require even more renewables in Pennsylvania's power mix. But those ideas will be tough to get through a Republican-led legislature. Lawmakers this year are expected to debate whether to rescue the state's nuclear industry. Like coal, it's struggling to compete with gas and renewables. Nuclear reactors provide Pennsylvania's largest source of carbon-free power, but several are slated to close prematurely. Here's Apt again.
Keeping those nuclear power plants operating as they are now is a very good low-pollution strategy.
In announcing his climate goals, Wolf did not say if he would support such a plan. He did indicate he wants to see more natural gas development. The concern for Schiebest with the Natural Resources Defense Council is that gas will replace nuclear, and gas produces emissions.
The emission reductions that we've seen in the past few years, I think, are not durable. I mean, they're vulnerable to going back up again unless we figure out energy policy that will really drive development of renewables.
That blueprint the state has for reducing emissions? It includes renewables, nuclear, electric vehicles, energy efficiency, and more. Robert Graff of the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission is on the state's Climate Change Advisory Committee.
You're not going to reach the goal with just these strategies.
They only get Pennsylvania halfway to its 2050 target.
You have to walk a narrow path between what's effective and what's economically feasible, and also what will have less disruption to the way people like to live.
Maybe technological advances, federal action, or a shift in people's willingness to change their lifestyles will get us the rest of the way there. But all of that, he says, is really hard to predict. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
And WESA's Amy Sisk joins us now in studio. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks, Kevin.
So let's take a look at about the how just realistic these goals are. 26% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. Where did the specific emissions reduction targets come from?
Yeah, so those percentages are something that are listed in the state's Climate Action Plan, which is this report that the Department of Environmental Protection releases every 3 years. The most recent version of it, a draft of it, came out this fall. It's going to be finalized probably this spring. And those percentages generally are what climate experts say are needed in order to prevent some really catastrophic impacts of climate change down the road. You know, really extreme droughts and flooding and hurricanes, things like that.
This 26% reduction, what sort of baseline are we talking about? From when?
From 2005 is kind of the baseline level.
Okay. How much, if anything, can the executive branch, can the governor do on his own, and how much cooperation is needed from the legislature?
The governor can do some things, though certainly the legislature is what's really needed to enact some of the big ticket items here. So Governor Wolf recently has set some new requirements to reduce methane, try to reduce methane leaks. And methane is this really potent greenhouse gas that can be released into the atmosphere from natural gas wells or from pipelines, things like that. But there's a lot of, you know, big things that really need to happen to see these significant emission reductions happen. And those are things like potentially bailing out the state's nuclear power industry, which has been struggling to compete with cheap natural gas and renewables. So that's something the legislature would have to do. There's other things that the legislature could do, too, like enacting a cap and trade system or a carbon tax. But again, that would have to take legislative action.
Right. Are other governors doing this as well?
So throughout the nation, there's about 22 states, I believe, that have enacted some sort of greenhouse gas emission reduction targets.
Now, is this due to President Trump's decision not to follow the Paris Climate Accord, and so therefore are states and cities sort of taking up the slack?
That's definitely part of it. And one thing that the Obama administration had done was enact something called the Clean Power Plan, which was this sweeping regulation that was going to require each state try to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. The Trump administration has rolled back that regulation and replaced it with something less stringent. So in lieu of that, you're seeing states states like Pennsylvania do moves like this. You're seeing cities like Pittsburgh release their own climate action plans.
You mentioned a moment ago about methane leaks. How is natural gas production affecting Pennsylvania's emissions overall?
So when you talk about natural gas and greenhouse gas emissions, there's really two things that you need to take into consideration. One is methane, which I already mentioned that, you know, Governor Wolf is enacting some rules to try to prevent methane from escaping. The other is carbon dioxide emissions from natural gas that's used for electricity generation. And so we're seeing this big transition away from coal to natural gas. Coal-fired power emits a lot of carbon dioxide. Natural gas emits about half of what coal does. So we are seeing some emission reductions because of that.
All right, you covered the event in Pittsburgh where the governor was talking about his goals. He said he doesn't have to choose between the economy and the environment.
If you want an either-or situation, I'm not your guy. I want to do both. I want to have an energy-efficient future. I want to have a strong environment. And I want to have a good economy in Pennsylvania. And I think we can do all those things.
You know, what Governor Wolf says is true, that natural gas provides a lot of good things for the economy, a lot of jobs, a lot of revenue for the state. But the reality of it is, as long as we have natural gas and fossil fuels that we're using for power generation, we are going to be producing greenhouse gas emissions because we just don't have the carbon capture technology in place yet to capture those emissions and store them somewhere.
All right. And quickly, you'll be taking part in an event this evening at the Energy Innovation Center called The Future of Energy. Can we get to zero carbon? Open to the public. What's going to happen?
Yeah, so this is at 6:15 p.m. tonight at the Energy Innovation Center in the Lower Hill District. This is it's a really cool building. It's very energy efficient. And so you're going to be able to take a tour of this building. And in addition to that, we're going to have a panel of experts who are going to be talking about climate change, both on a local scale and a global scale. So again, 6:15 p.m. If you want to learn more, visit WESA.FM/zero carbon for more information.
Amy Sisk reports for WESA and State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. How secure will our voting system be in time for next year's presidential election? The Blue Ribbon Commission on Pennsylvania's Election Security issued its final report this morning on ways to make the system more secure, at least here in Pennsylvania. We're going to discuss the recommendations with the co-chair of the commission, David Hickton, former U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, the founding director of the University of Pittsburgh's Institute of for Cyber Law, Policy, and Security. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be back.
Remind us, why was the commission created in the first place, and what was its assignment?
We created the commission as a private group of public-spirited individuals who were concerned about the obvious a threat to our election security that was manifest in the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm.
And our goal was to create a bipartisan commission that covered the state of Pennsylvania and to see what we could offer with respect to giving assistance to the decision makers at the state of Pennsylvania.
All right. Also joining us on the line from Grove City is the president of Grove City College and your co-chair on this commission, Paul McNulty. Paul, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So, Paul, let me ask you, what's wrong with our current system? What's your take on that?
Well, the problem is that we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable to attacks on the integrity of the vote in a variety of ways. We're vulnerable to the perception of an attack, a campaign by an organized threat to claim that the election has been stolen, and the question is, how do we counter that claim? But we're also threatened by the technical side of the voting architecture, particularly the voting machines, in that there's ways to manipulate the software in order to also affect the vote. So the vulnerabilities, which we lay out in our report, are multiple, and that's why we have such a sense of urgency about addressing them.
remind us, David and Paul, you know, the Pennsylvania was one of several states targeted in 2016. How so?
Yeah, the information on what happened in 2016 is still evolving, but there were several states, including Pennsylvania, where it's absolutely clear to me that the Russian intelligence groups were trolling within our system. Mm-hmm. There were some states where they have acknowledged even more, like Illinois, that they believed that there was direct evidence of hacking. Mm-hmm. But the numbers vary from 21 states, which were notified by the Department of Homeland Security in 2016, to some estimates as high as 40.
Paul, I want to put this one to you first, and that is, how much resistance, even denial, did you and the commission run into about whether there is a security problem, or is it universally accepted? Paul, we'll start with you on that one.
Well, my impression was we didn't run into a significant amount of resistance. I mean, this is a substantial investment to address the problem, and naturally, state and county officials are concerned about the cost, and they raise those issues, and we all understand the importance of that concern. And then there was some discussion about how the vulnerabilities would play out, and you know, confidence among a lot of county officials that they're doing a good job. And I would say, David, I would say that that's true. They're doing a good job under the circumstances. The important finding here is that there's a vulnerability that just can't be ignored. And even if we're able to manage through past elections, we're living on borrowed time. And we have to figure out a way to ensure that the vote won't be stolen.
Mm-hmm. I want you each, now you issued your interim recommendations in September. Today, the final recommendations, the final report. I'm going to start with David on this one. I want you to each pick one of the most important recommendations you think in this report. David, we'll start with you. What do you think, one that's absolutely necessary to adopt?
Well, let me give you just a quick prelude to that, Kevin, that it's important for your listeners to understand we looked at the machines, we looked at the voter rolls, and we looked at resiliency challenges. Those are the three broad areas we looked at. And we issued recommendations, interim recommendations on the first topic, the machines, earlier, and we amplified them in today's reports. So with respect to the machines, the most important recommendation is we need to move away from the so-called DRE machines.
What's that stand for?
Direct reporting. Mm-hmm. And they have been demonstrated to be eminently hackable. And we use them in over 80% of the precincts in Pennsylvania.
Including Allegheny County?
Yes.
Okay. Paul, what do you think is one of the key recommendations in this final report?
Well, I will add that the I think the audits, we call them risk limiting audit, but the idea of having a practice in place where we would, through kind of a statistically reliable process, validate or verify that the process went well, that the votes that were identified match the records that we have. I think that's a really important recommendation as well, because it will not only satisfy our concerns about the risk, but it will also bolster public confidence that we really do have a strong democratic process that is not being undermined by, you know, bad actors.
All right. And we will provide a link to the entire report on the WESA website later today. So let's talk a little bit more about the machines. The Wolf administration, the Pennsylvania Department of State, has now certified four types of machines that it approves of that leave, basically, it's a paper record is what they do. And the governor said, I'll commit $14 million, but how much are we talking about for new machines for all of these precincts? David, you mentioned, I believe, 80% in the state would need this. How much of a dollar figure are we talking about?
It's going to be a sizable sum of money, and we've been loath to try and be specific and identify and own a number, but some have said $125 million. And so far, the federal authorities haven't committed their fair share to that. And as Paul said, we have this concern that's very valid at the local level that we don't want to spend money we don't need to spend and encumber the taxpayers with this expense. At the same time, if you use the $125 million number, it's $9 or so per Pennsylvanian, and it is a capital expense that's overdue even if we were not vulnerable. These machines we use are approaching 20 years old, and with the vulnerability and the expected end of their work life, it's time to replace them just like we would replace a fire truck or another piece of capital equipment.
Yeah. Paul, if the feds do not kick in some money, what's your recommendation for how to pay for these for the new equipment?
Well, there are, I think, three things that have to be kept in mind. Of course, appropriations, whether it's the Fed or the state. I think that David and I and others are looking to the state more than the feds as far as where the appropriations can come from. And I have some optimism that there will be some appropriation. I think bonds are another realistic possibility and have worked well in high priority situations for a long time. And thirdly, I'm, you know, talking to you this morning from Mercer County, which is a rural county north of Allegheny County. And Mercer County has already put together a plan for replacing the machines. And one of the things that it's doing, it's going to cost $1 million, is closing some precincts that are being underutilized in order to save money. And I think that kind of good stewardship and smart planning could actually help us with controlling the costs on this thing.
And we have just a couple of minutes left. I believe the Department of State, Pennsylvania's Department of State, have told the counties you have to have these new machines in place at least by the primary of 2020. Can it be done in a little more than a year from now?
I believe it can. Virginia did it very fast. I don't think we really want to do this in the middle of the 2020 presidential election. It would be optimal if we could do it in anticipation of an election this year, if there's a problem we need to address.
Okay. Paul, what I wanted to ask you this, without making any of these recommended security upgrades, the new machine, just how easy is it to disrupt, to change, to influence the voting process as it exists right now?
You know, it's interesting. On the one hand, it's extremely easy because of the nature of social media and what we have seen in recent elections, and that's the attempt to influence the perception of what's going on. So on the one hand, you wouldn't have to do anything, and you'd be able to say that something has occurred, and the question is, how do we counter that with some kind of reliable verification that it hasn't occurred? But on the other hand, you do have the, you know, the cyber attacks, the actual manipulation of software that's going into the machines. And our commission looked at that, and certainly there have been tests done that have demonstrated that vulnerability, so we know it's real. And yet at the same time, it does take some sophistication to figure out how to attack and manipulate, undermine the software in the machines. And not all the machines are following best practices. That is, they're not standalone. We call them air-gapped machines that would be better protected from the harm. And so to the extent best practices aren't followed, there's some even easier cyber attacks that could occur.
And final question to David, and that is this. How much of this is actually tightening the security of our election process? How much of it is to instill public confidence that when they vote, their selections for offices will actually get that vote?
They're both involved. Just like any business, a good cyber hygiene would make us safer. And as Paul said, keeping the voter confident that the elections have integrity is paramount.
David Hickton is founding director of the University of Pittsburgh Cyber Institute. Paul McNulty is president of Grove City College. They are the co-chairs of the Blue Ribbon Commission on Pennsylvania's Election Security, which issued its final report this morning on recommendations to make the election system more secure. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be with you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Mayor Bill Peduto is not backing down, challenging DA Stephen Zappala to arrest him if Peduto signs a bill to restrict some guns in the city. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan.
The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.